Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. The spirit of 76 might reflect the 76 years since the advent of the nuclear age, which began on July 16, 1945, with the first ever human-manufactured nuclear explosion in a New Mexico desert known as the Day of Trinity. So perhaps we might backstroke and create a new calendar to describe and define this startling new era that is dramatically secular and non-religious. The so-called Christian calendar of the past two millennia plus two decades was itself backdated about three centuries after the death of Jesus Christ by a group of theological scholars who guesstimated the date of the crucifixion. Saint Augustine was among the scholars. This brand new calendar might simply be the nuclear age, as in 76 NA, to reposition this year. The past is definitely prologue. And now I'd like to read something I wrote. Mushrooms of August, with a quote by the great Kate Wolfe. Now the sun has come to earth, shrouded in a mushroom cloud of death. The nuclear age began 76 years ago, which might eventually be recognized by changing the calendar from a religious accounting to a secularistic register of human life after Adam, rather than the biblical Adam. The mushroom cloud was first seen in the sky in a New Mexico desert, USA. It quickly became the tombstone of two Japanese cities. Hiroshima was the first on August 6, 1945. Nagasaki was next 3 days later on August 9th. Less than a week afterward, humanity's most terrible war was over. If ever there was a prime pivotal moment in human history, that was it. All the discoveries of science and their application to warfare culminated in the splitting of the atom and its exploitation as an apocalyptic weapon of annihilation. Warfare might have ceased at that point with realization that its ultimate potential was human extinction. Instead, the world's war planners seemed oblivious to oblivion and devised devilishly more destructive nuclear weapons while simultaneously continuing traditional warfare on much smaller scale than the two world wars. A new description in military lexicon, limited war, that might or might not be pushed up to nearly an irreversible point of obliterating civilization and humanity. The world's most experienced experts on the effects and consequences of nuclear weapons were the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. As many as 140,000 people died instantly from the bomb in Hiroshima and 70,000 in Nagasaki. The death toll from incipient radiation was much higher than from injuries of the bomb blast. At least 130,000 died from radiation poisoning in the next 5 years. Decades later, people continued to die from wounds compounded with radiation from the two nuclear bombs. Now, 76 years later, nearly all survivors are dead. Everybody alive in the world since 1945 have lived their entire lives since under the shadow of nuclear war. The abnormal is explicitly normal, crossing two millennia of what might now be considered an obsolete calendar. The year is now 76 of the nuclear age, its icon, the mushroom cloud, rather than the crucifix. Yet since the beginning of the nuclear age, very few seem able to confront and literally metabolize the horror that nuclear weaponry represent. it is difficult to hold for very long onto the aberrant grotesquery of possible holocaust, the scale of a living world annihilated so instantaneously, as well as the thought of its likely imminence, seems too insane to sustain sanity. For sanity's sake, most people would rather not be reminded that they live in an age of plutonium, and that wherever they live only minutes away from a nuclear missile that has their address. To do something about the specter of nuclear obliteration means to acknowledge its probability, as though ignorance is a protective vacuity and defense of helplessness, a formidable defense of the unthinkable. Hardly is anyone so formidable as when defending personal helplessness. So it is with the threat of nuclear holocaust. There is nothing anyone can do, is the motto of genial futility. Yet, not exactly in the words of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the only futility is the futility of futility itself, especially in regard to the prospect of world suicide. The prospect of nuclear devastation is not a bad joke played on humanity by a merciless deity. It is the product of human beings and a human problem of human scope and magnitude that can only be remedied by humanity. Humans will either obliterate humanity through nuclear holocaust, climate disaster, or some other human-caused catastrophe, or preserve itself, which would be an indication that the species might be worth preserving through its courage and intelligence to try. Where to begin could be as René Dubos advises environmentalists: think universally, act locally. The obsessive secrecy of the nuclear priesthood has effectively removed the public from active participation in the most critical issue that faces humanity. Americans have been made to opt out and, from the very beginning, denied their right to know about nuclear policies, which has contributed to their gradual alienation from participation in crucial life and death issues that affect humanity as a whole. The development of nuclear energy was from the initial splitting of the atom, shrouded in secrecy, a dark paradox that vast numbers of American citizens could be organized to create a horror such as the bomb without really knowing they were doing it, which was the sinister advent of the so-called national security state. The effect was to remove the public from all nuclear issues and render them a process of a very few who, in the short term at least, have profited immensely from public monies poured into development of nuclear armaments for three quarters of a century. The immense fortunes made by nuclear arms manufacturers quite obviously overwhelms qualms of human extinction, and the consequence of draining trillions plus of taxpayers' dollars into the private fortunes of munitions makers, in tandem with the rubric of national defense priorities, places these weapons of mass destruction czars beyond public scrutiny and accountability, and their publicly provided wealth gives them tremendous political power, which is usually arch-conservative and anti-democratic in nature. The nuclear age works a double liability. It erodes democracy at a fundamental level and holds its citizenry hostage to the dread and oppressive secrecy it invokes. Surrendering the right to know nuclear secrecy has contributed to the public's alienation from the political process in general, and in particular has unforgivably deceived Americans about the most basic concern of when and by whose hand or lethal technology were they to die. The development and use of atomic bombs on Japan will be disputed long after World War II diminishes to history as ancient as Hannibal's crossing the Alps with elephants to war against Rome. The advent of the nuclear age will most likely be a topic of debate for the rest of history. Then, at the origin of the nuclear age, could have been the opportunity, if there has ever been one, to put an end to warfare as a response to the real probability of human suicide. The result instead was a neurotic balance of terror that posed perpetual nuclear escalation between two empires that used the threat of each other for half a century of unabated global fear and loathing. We cannot uninvent nuclear weapons, or for that matter, unsplit the atom. The knowledge is with us as long as Homo sapiens defies its own handicaps and dwells in the galaxy. If we are not smart enough to contain our nuclear goblin, our incinerated cities will be indelible traces that a vanished species once briefly and foolishly occupied a third planet from its sun. A species extinction might begin when increasing numbers of its members lose hope for themselves and their future, when they stop their inner clocks because they perceive life as unbearable or useless. Some lasting effect must be a result of hopelessness, a decline, a loss of energy and will, and the incipient cleverness indispensable for survival. The human race is not unlike any other life form that has lived temporarily on Earth. Like its individual members, the species must eventually die, and like a person, it can die at any age or stage of its development. The richness of its past, its dreams or schemes, its success and failures, none of these is a case against death. The very quality that enforced human rule over the Earth, our ruthless and intelligent violence, is the primary obstacle to our continued existence. We differ from our extinct predecessors in that our threatened oblivion is from our own industry and in the possibility that we might overcome our history and survive a while longer. It is the great mass of ordinary people who will and must prevent world suicide, whether nuclear or biocide, or through atmospheric incineration. It must be done by everyone, beginning with each one. Each of us will die, either privately or as part of a massacre or extinction of our species, if we do not arrest the dangers of nuclear violence. There are good reasons we must each die, primary among them, to make room and leave a few resources for our descendants. What is different now is that we must step outside our small fears and immediate prejudices and ensure an inhabitable world for our inheritors. There has never been a more personal or more universal struggle in our history. Scores of nuclear doomsday books written by such writers as Neville Chute, Pat Frank, Philip Wiley, Henry Brinton, and George H. Smith, among quite a few others, have fed a morbidly voracious dread of nuclear holocaust. But M. L. Graham, formerly of Arch Cape, Oregon, and its longtime fire marshal, tersely captured the basic scenario of these end of civilization as we know it novels in three paragraphs, which he wrote for the North Coast Times Eagle. Ground Zero by M. L. Graham. More brilliant than a thousand noonday suns, the flash and racing inferno poured down from the sky, and in an instant a countryside turned to ash. Little girls with delicate skin were cremated in pink dresses. Old men on park benches vanished. Gone also were the benches, and the shade trees flared into burning forests. Shadows were burnt into the ground the instant bone and blood burned away. Seeds that had contained such promise were scorched to lifeless pits by a cosmic zephyr traveling at the speed of death. Love and hope, in its way, were disintegrated. The giants of war had flung their spears with unyielding and pitiless menace They had squeezed a formula for horror out of the earth, then shaped laws around bombs that turned the simple atom into a destroyer of worlds. The bombs quickly became the intent of laws, and the laws became hopelessly snarled with the laws and bombs of enemies. The drift to the final war was inevitable because nothing was done to prevent it. A shower of radiation particles fell gently like an invisible snow upon the charred land, covering the smoking rubbish piles that had been alive moments before. There was silence, a crazy kind of silence. And that was by M.L. Graham. And now, by Dr. Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington, Put 'Em Up. Actor Bert Lahr portrayed the cowardly lion, Zeke, in the 1939 film, The Wizard of Oz. The dandy lion was, well, afraid of everything. But thanks to The Wizard of Oz, safely ensconced behind a smokescreen, Zeke discovered that he did possess courage, successfully encountering the Wicked Witch's palace guards. I am convinced we are in dire need of political courage in 2021, as we have endured the consequences of the toadies and sycophants in the Trump administration. Lacking any backbone, Trump and his crime family made courage scarce. But it hasn't always been that way. I can enumerate 9 examples of political courage exhibited by members of both political parties and from abroad as well. Consider Eugene Debs, 5-time socialist candidate for president, who served 10 years in prison for violating the 1917 Espionage Act for his anti-war pronouncements. Montana Congresswoman Jeanette Rankin was a suffragist who courageously opposed American involvement in World War I and World War II. She was the first woman ever elected to Congress, a true patriot. Mahatma Gandhi advocated nonviolence to protest British rule in India. His influence on Martin Luther King was enormous. Progressive Henry Wallace was an uncommon farmer who served as vice president during FDR's third term, displaying courage and integrity while incurring the wrath of Harry Truman. But the Bernie Sanders of 1944 stood up to it and retired to a quiet life of farming. John F. Kennedy, assisted extensively by Ted Sorensen, wrote the Pulitzer Prize winner Profiles in Courage, depicting his notion of courage, displayed by 8 U.S. senators. Perhaps more important was Kennedy's own personal courage as commander of the torpedo boat PT-109 as he helped save crew members. 4-term Idaho Senator Frank Church, 1957-81, showed real courage in opposing the Vietnam War. U.S. Senator Paul Wellstone, 1991-2002, was a true progressive, advocating peace, health care for all, care of the environment, the importance of immigration, and respect for labor. Wellstone exhibited one act of political courage after another throughout his career. Nelson Mandela, a courageous South African leader, spent 27 years in prison for his opposition to apartheid. Mandela famously observed that courage is not the absence of fear, but the triumph over it. Vietnam War hero Senator John McCain displayed political courage when he issued his thumbs down vote on repealing the Affordable Care Act. And Senator Mitt Romney showed courage as the only Republican senator to vote for the impeachment of Donald Trump. Of course, I value the non-political courage shown by first responders, the healthcare servants attending COVID-19 victims, and the firemen and police officers who daily put their lives on the line. I hope millions of Americans repudiate Trump's fear-mongering, rising up to triumph over him. put them up, put them up. And that was Dr. Robert Brake from Ocean Park, Washington. And this is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schalk engineers this program. Piano by Keith Jarrett. A man I greatly admire died in Astoria last month after a long illness at the age of 73. His name was Charles Scott Parker, whose family settled in Astoria during pioneer years of the 19th century. Scott Parker was the sort of man most men wish to be, and perhaps most women wish for men to be. Scotty lived a vigorous and adventurous life. He was an athlete and a soldier, an airborne infantry machine gunner in the Vietnam War. He spent most of his life as a Pacific Ocean saltwater mariner, having grown up on Astoria's waterfront. He crewed and skippered fish boats and tugboats and served aboard Astoria's renowned salvage chief. And he was a splendid raconteur, speaking sagas of persons, places, and phenomena ashore and afloat. Ironically, one other man I equally admired, Arthur Honeyman, might be considered a direct opposite to Scotty. Arthur was born with cerebral palsy and had little control over his spasticating body, yet his determined courage and vital intelligence were a match with Scotty. And Arthur turned out to be a cousin of Scotty. Scotty and Arthur were both descended from an early Astoria postmaster during the Civil War, Charles Parker. When I realized the connection, I attempted to introduce them and was able to acquaint them with the fact of their kinship. But Arthur, who was a mentor and example for many thousands of physical and mentally handicapped persons, died before he and Scotty were able to meet in person. I regret they had not known each other. They were both simpatico in many fundamental ways. Each was quite naturally indomitable, confronted with adversity, yet warm and generous in spirit and humor. And both were consummate storytellers, Scotty in the oral tradition and Arthur through script and poetry, though for many years he agonizingly dictated verbally to hired scribes until he was able to transcribe his work on a computer keyboard with a single spastic, shaky finger. It was my good fortune to know both men, and I think they would have been impressed with each other. At least they did know of each other, and the mega admiration and respect I felt toward both. And now a poem by Arthur Honeyman, Genesis and Finale. In a timeless university, on a certain speck of cosmic material, a phenomenon of individual activity evolved and separated from the oneness of natural forces, though the umbilical connection remained, individuality destroyed timelessness forever, and it became a space problem, and it became a linguistic problem, creating and institutionalizing the meaning of existence and the deities to determine the fate that must be accepted at all costs. For those synthetic boxes shall crumble and experience the ravages of synthetic flames. Poof, sometime about now, the nuclear hordes blast individuality into oblivion, mushrooming, vaporizing, timelessly again, and imperialism disappears from linguistic rescue. So much for punctuating the burst of the bubble from within. Poof, as for me, I row, 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 my boat briskly down the stream. Merrily, 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 life reigns supreme. And that was by Arthur Honeyman. He wrote that in 1986. Fortunately, American renters will not be kicked out into the street exactly at the moment of deadly virus resurgence. So use the reprieve to lock down this renewed bad time. Remember, protecting yourself helps safeguard everyone else. And remember Hiroshima and Nagasaki.